Namaskaram. Today I'm going to be talking about the 19th paragraph of Nana. There is a connection between one paragraph to the next throughout this work. In the 13th paragraph, for example, Bhagavan defines self-surrender, saying that the implication, this isn't the exact translation, the implication of that first sentence of the 13th paragraph is being so keenly self-attentive that we thereby give no room to rising of any other thoughts is giving oneself to God. No, but that is surrender. And then he goes on in that paragraph to say that we need to emphasize that we need not think anything. We can put the entire burden, even the burden of thinking, we can put that burden on God. So we should be just like a wise passenger on a train who puts their luggage aside rather than carrying it on their head and travels comfortably. So our aim is to there's no need for us even to think. We can leave even the burden of thinking to Bhagavan. He will take care of everything. He will take care of whatever is to happen in our life. It will happen as it's meant to happen. So we can leave even the burden of thinking to him. So this is, in a way, these later paragraphs are a continuation of that same idea. But we need not be concerned about anything other than ourselves. We need not be interested in anything other than ourselves. In the 17th paragraph, for example, Bhagavan says that it's futile to make to investigate or do research on how many tattvas and what are the qualities of the tattvas. Tattvas means basic ontological principles. Most systems of philosophy have some concept of what are the basic ontological principles, what are the basic things that exist from which everything else is built up. In Indian systems of philosophy, such ontological principles are called tattvas, and they're various. Each philosophy enumerates its own set of tattva, the basic ingredients of all things. So Bhagavan says, that the implication of what Bhagavan says in this paragraph, all these are not ourselves. They are simply concealing ourselves. So we should not investigate these. We should not do research on these. And we should not be concerned about how many tattvas there are and what are the qualities of all the tattvas. It's all futile because our aim is to know ourselves. That is the implication of the first sentence of that paragraph. What Bhagavan says in that first sentence, that applies not only to Indian systems of philosophy, but all systems of philosophy, and also to science and all other knowledge systems. That is, when we come to this spiritual path, it's fine for other people. If people are interested in making research on science or on philosophy or history or whatever it may be, that's fine. But if we are coming to this spiritual path, we need to withdraw our interest from all things other than ourselves. We maybe cannot give up our interest in other things all at once, but our aim is to wean our mind off its interest in other things. And then he ends that paragraph by saying, it is necessary to consider the world like a dream. That is, this whole world, according to Bhagavan, it's nothing but, is no more real than any world that we perceive in a dream. It's just our own mental fabrication. So we need to be so indifferent to everything other than ourselves. And then he continues the same idea in the next paragraph, the 18th paragraph, in which he discusses in more detail this the subject of this waking world being actually no more real than a dream world. He says he begins by saying, except that waking is said to be long and dream is said to be short, There is no other difference. But even that difference in Guru Vachaka Kovai, he says it's only from the perspective of the mind in the waking state that dream seems to be short and waking seems to be long. What makes any state seem to be long is memories. But the same memories that we have in the waking state, we have those memories in dreams. So the state we then seem to be in seems to be waking and it seems to be long. So all these are just differences in perspective. There's no substantive difference between waking and dream. And he goes on to say that to what extent all the viviharas, all the transactions, all the activities, all the events that happen in the waking state, to what extent everything happening in the waking state seems to be real, to that extent everything that happens in dream seems to be real so long as we're dreaming. So the main point of this paragraph is the waking state is no more real than the dream state. So this is the implication is that we should not be concerned about what is happening in the outside world. What we should be concerned in about, if we are serious about following the spiritual path, we should be concerned with one thing and one thing alone, knowing who am I. And to know who am I, we need to lose interest in all other things and take interest only in turning our attention within to see what we actually are. So what Bhagavan is saying in the 19th paragraph is a continuation of that same theme, but we need not take interest in, we shouldn't have likes and dislikes for things other than ourselves. When we look out and see the world, we see all sorts of people in this world. We see some people who seem to be very good people, some people who seem to be very bad people. And if we are basically good-natured people, we like to see justice in this world. We like to see fairness. We don't like to see people who are greedy, who are exploiting others and things. We think, oh, these people who are taking advantage of others, that's bad. So we have so many judgments about what is good and what is bad in this world, and which people are good and which people are bad. So Bhagavan begins by talking about this. What he says in the first sentence is, Nalamanam Indram, Ketamanam Indram, Irendu Manangal Ille. That means there are not two minds, namely a good mind and a bad mind. Then in the next sentence he says, Manamandre, mind is only one. And then in the next sentence he says, Vasane gale subham endram asubham endram irendividam. Only vasanas are of two kinds, namely subha and asubha. Vasanas means inclinations. Subha means agreeable, virtuous, or good. Asubha means the opposite, disagreeable, wicked, harmful, or bad. So what Bhagavan is saying here, the mind is neutral. What we judge as good or bad is the vasanas. And then he goes on in the fourth sentence to say, Manam subhavasane vayatai nikkumpodu nalamanamendram. When the mind is under the sway of subhavasanas, it is said to be a good mind. A subhavasane vasane vayatai nikkumpodu ketamanam indram. When it is under the sway of asubha vasanas, it is said to be a bad mind. In other words, what Bhagavan is pointing out, it's the problem is vasanas. We call someone bad if they behave in a bad manner, if they're selfish, if they're greedy, if they don't care about others. So those behaviors which we call bad behaviors are caused because the mind is under the sway of a subhavasanas. And other people, we say they're good people, they're kind, they're generous, charitable, help, they're always willing to help others and generally good people. We call them good because their mind happens to be under the sway of good vasana, a sub-mind. So what makes a person seem to be good or seem to be bad is whether they're under the sway of good vasanas or bad vasanas. Here, Bhagavan gives, that is, when we read what Bhagavan has written, in whether in Nana or Uludhanapadu or Upadeshundia Anma Vidhi or Arunachastuti Pancham, when we read Bhagavan's words, we need to understand not only the meaning of what Bhagavan is saying, we also need to understand the implication. And in this sentence, this fourth sentence, there's a lot of implication, because what Bhagavan implies here is that our behavior is determined, it's how we behave shows how, what kind of vasanas we are under the sway of. So it is vasanas that influence our behavior. This is why he says, for example, in the second verse of Upadeshundia, he says, the fruit of action passes away. When we do any action, it produces a certain fruit. If we do good actions, it produces good fruit. If we do bad actions, it produces bad fruit. Those fruit we don't experience immediately. They get stored in what is called sanchitta. And from sanchitta, for each lifetime, God selects certain fruit for us to experience. Those fruit that we are to experience in this lifetime are what are called prarabdha. Once we experience the fruit of any action, that fruit is finished. That is, you can't experience the same fruit more than once. If someone gives you a mango, you can only eat that mango once. You can't eat it today and again eat it tomorrow. Once it's eaten, it's finished. Likewise with the fruit of action. Once we've experienced the fruit of an action, it is finished. So the fruit of action are transitory. We do the action, the fruit is there waiting for us to experience it. We will experience it only when God gives it to us to experience, because God knows what are the most appropriate fruit for us to experience at any particular time. According to our spiritual development, he decides which fruit will be conducive to our spiritual development, and he allots those fruit for us to experience as prarabdha. So once we experience the fruit, they pass away. But he then goes on to say, vittai, vine kadal virtidam, as seed, they cause to fall in the ocean of action. What he means there by seed is the vasanas. That is, what makes us do any action that bears fruit is only the vasanas. When we act under the sway of our vasanas, the actions that we do under the sway of our vasanas are what are called agamya. Those are the actions that bear fruit. So the cause for our falling in the ocean of action is the vasanas. That's why he says the vasanas are seeds. They're the seeds that give rise to all likes, dislikes, desires, attachments, hopes, fears, and consequently to all actions of mind, speech, and body. So the cause of all karma is vasanas. This is what Bhagavan is implying in this sentence. When our mind is under the sway of subhavasanas, good vasanas, it's called a good, our behavior is good, and so we're called a good person. If our mind is under the sway of bad vasanas, our behavior will be bad, and so we're called a bad person. So it is the vasanas that cause us to act. But vasanas are only inclinations. So we are not bound by our inclinations. We may be inclined to do a certain thing, but we can restrain ourselves. We can avoid doing things that we're inclined to do. In fact, we're constantly, that is, we have so many vasanas, so many inclinations that are pulling our mind in so many different directions. So we're constantly choosing whether to be swayed by this vasana or that vasana. Often our vasanas may be pulling us in opposite directions. We may like to do something, but we know that thing isn't good for us. So though on the one hand, we have a liking to do it. On another hand, we have a liking to refrain from doing it. So the vasanas are pulling us in different directions. It's up to us which vasanas we allow to sway us and whether we allow ourselves to be swayed by any vasanas at all. So all action is cause when that is the cause for all action is our allowing ourselves to be swayed by our vasanas. That's why Bhagavan says, it's as seeds, that the vasanas, by seeds there, he means the vasanas. The vasanas that cause us to fall in the great ocean of action. So what he refers to in the Sanskrit version of that verse as kriti maho dado patanakaranam, the cause for falling in this great ocean of action. He doesn't specify it in Sanskrit, but in Tamil he makes it clear. It is the vasanas, it is the seeds. So the vasanas are the cause for action. But vasanas, we are not bound by our vasanas. Vasanas cannot make us act. It's only when we allow ourselves to be swayed by them that we act. So this is, there's a, Bhagavan, in this sentence, he gives us a very important clue about the nature of vasanas. And the only other place in Nana, where he specifically talks about the sway of vasanas, in the eighth paragraph of Nana, he says, for the mind to cease, except vicharana, that self-investigation, there is no other adequate means. If made to cease or subside by other means, the mind remaining for a while as if it had ceased will again rise up. And then he goes on to say, even by pranayama, that's breath restraint, the mind will cease or subside. However, so long as the prana remains subsided, mind will also remain subsided. And when prana emerges, the mind will also emerge. And he says, and wander under the sway of its vasanas. That is, anal pranam adangi irkum varayal. So long as the prana remains subsided, manamam adangi irandu. The mind will also remain subsided. Pranam veli padam podu. When the prana comes out, tanam here means itself, meaning the mind also will come out, vasane vayatai alayam. It will wander under the sway of its vasanas. So all mental activity is caused by vasanas, and mental activity leads to activities of speech and a body. So all actions are caused by vasanas. So vasanas are the problem, but it's only here, as in this sentence in this fourth sentence of the 19th paragraph, in this sentence, the term he uses, he says, vasane vayatai. Vayam is a Tamil form of the Sanskrit word vasam, which means control or sway. So it's when we allow ourselves to be swayed by vasanas, but we act, any movement of our attention away from ourselves towards anything else is under the sway of our vasanas. So if we want to avoid being swayed by vasanas, to avoid being swayed by all types of vishaya vasanas, that vasanas to attend to anything other than ourselves, the only means is to cling firmly to self-attentiveness. Because if we attend to anything else, anything other than ourselves, it's under the sway of some vishaya vasana. Maybe a relatively good vishaya vasana or a relatively bad vishaya vasana, but still a vishaya vasana. And all vishaya vasanas ultimately are bad because they make us inclined to attend to things other than ourselves. Whereas if we want to know what we actually are and thereby to surrender ourselves completely, to annihilate this ego, we need to hold on to self-attentiveness without allowing ourselves to be swayed by our vasanas. The more we allow ourselves to be swayed by any particular vasana, the stronger that vasana becomes. The less we allow ourselves to be swayed by a vasana, the weaker it becomes. So when we practice self-investigation, we are clinging firmly to self-attentiveness and thereby not allowing ourselves to be swayed by our vishaya vasanas. So that is how our vishaya vasanas are weakened by the practice of self-investigation. And it's also why there is no shortcut. We have to do this practice of trying to turn our attention back to ourselves. The more we turn our attention back to ourselves, the weaker our vishaya vasanas become, and the stronger our sattvasana becomes. Sattvasana means the inclination just to be as we actually are, to know and to be what we actually are. That is sattvasana. That sattvasana is what is otherwise called bhakti, love. So in order to strengthen the sattvasana and weaken the vishaya vasanas, the only means is to cling firmly to self-attentiveness. Of course, we can weaken vishaya vasanas by other means, but we can't weaken all of them, because any means other than self-investigation entails attending to something other than ourselves. Attending to anything other than ourselves is attending to a vishaya, and we attend to vishayas under the sway of our vishaya vasanas. So though other means can help to weaken the vishaya vasanas to a certain extent, we can weaken all of them and eradicate all of them only by means of self-investigation. So this word that Bhagavan uses here in this sentence in the 19th paragraph, and also in that sentence in the 8th paragraph, vasanai vayatai, this is a very, very important word. It means under the sway of our vasanas. So any thought we think, any liking we have, any desire we have, any action we do, all ultimately come back to we have allowed ourselves to be swayed by vishaya vasanas. So, as I say, there's a lot more implication in what Bhagavan says than maybe the surface meaning. The surface meaning of this sentence is, when the mind is under the sway of subhavasanas, it's said to be a good mind. And when it's under the sway of asubhavasanas, it's said to be a bad mind. But if we think deeply about it, there's a huge amount of implication in this. And we need to understand not only the meaning of what Bhagavan is saying, but also the implications. And when we first read Bhagavan's teachings, we won't understand all the implications. But the more and more we read his teachings, and most importantly, the more we put them into practice, the clearer the implications of what he says will become to us. It's good to read Bhagavan's teachings repeatedly, but we shouldn't just stop with reading and thinking about them. We need to put them into practice, because the real clarity comes to the extent to which we put them into practice. If we look at the map of a faraway country we've never been to, we may be able to learn so many things about that country, but in relation to this town, there's a mountain here, there's a river here. We'll know all these things, but our knowledge of that country is very, very superficial. To fully understand what all that is implied in that map, we need to go to that country and say, oh, this is the mountain that's marked here, this is the river that's marked here, this is what it looks like. So likewise, we can understand Bhagavan's teachings to a certain extent by reading them and thinking about them, by sravana and manana. But to really deeply understand what Bhagavan is saying and what is the implication of what he's saying, it's essential that we put it into practice. So practice is all important. That's why Bhagavan's teaching, if we understand Bhagavan's teachings, whatever he says has practical implications, because Bhagavan has one aim and one aim alone: to get us to turn our attention back to ourselves. That is the sole aim of all of Bhagavan's teachings. Because only when our attention turns back to ourselves can we know ourselves as we actually are, and thereby be free of ego. And then in the next sentence, the fifth sentence, he says, Pira evalo ketavagalai tondrinam avagalai Veritel ahadu. That means, however bad other people may appear to be, disliking them is not proper. This is where Bhagavan is leading to. That is, at first he says, there are not two minds, a good mind and a bad mind. Mind is only one. The reason there seem to be good minds and bad minds is because of vasanas. When the mind's under the sway of bad vasanas, it's called a bad mind. When it's under the sway of good vasanas, it's called a good mind. So, however bad people appear to be, we shouldn't dislike them. We should feel sorry for them, but they are under the sway of asubha vasanas, or bad vasanas, and consequently they're behaving in this bad way. That is, we judge people according to their behavior. If we say someone is good, it's because their behavior is good. If we say someone is bad, it's because their behavior is bad. What makes their behavior good or bad is what type of vasanas they allow themselves to be swayed by. So if we see someone behaving in a bad way, we see all sorts of things in this world, people behaving in so many disagreeable manners. It's because they're under the sway of disagreeable vasanas. So who are the first people who suffer from their disagreeable behavior? They themselves. That is, fire first burns the place where it starts from. So if we see, if we behave in a bad way, we are the first person we are causing trouble to is ourselves. We are, that is, people who behave badly, people who are greedy, who are who exploit others, they do so because they're not happy themselves. And we can't find happiness in being in selfishness and greed and exploiting others or taking advantage of others. True happiness lies only within us. So if we are greedy and avaricious and jealous and all these bad qualities, we'll be making we are displaying these bad qualities because we've got bad vasanas, and those vasanas will be making us suffer. That is, someone who makes other people suffer, they're making other people suffer because they're not happy themselves. If they were happy themselves, they wouldn't want to make other people suffer. So when we see people behaving badly, we shouldn't dislike them. If anything, we should just feel sorry for them. But we now feel, oh, these people are bad. They're behaving in a way we wouldn't behave in this way. We may take some pride, but we are better people or something. Even that we shouldn't be feeling, because we ourselves will have behaved like this in the past. That is why we're experiencing all the troubles we're experiencing now. Whatever unpleasant experiences we experience in our present life, and all of us experience unpleasant experiences, those are the fruit of improper actions that we've done in the past. So we may see other people acting in a heartless way or in a greedy way or something. We may think, oh, they're so bad, but we were ourselves like that at one time. So it's there but for the grace of God go I, as they say. That is only because by Bhagavan's grace that we have been drawn to this path, and whatever good vasanas we have, it's only here by under the guidance of his grace that we slowly weaned ourselves off our less good vasanas and cultivated gradually better vasanas. It's all only by his grace. So when we see other people who are bad, we shouldn't dislike them. We should feel sorry for them. But we also, not only we shouldn't dislike them, we also shouldn't feel superior to them, because we as Bhagavan says, mind is only one. It's just the vasanas are different. So they just happen to be unfortunate to be still under the sway of particularly bad vasanas. We're also under the sway of bad vasanas. Any vasana, any vishaya vasana, in other words, any vasana that draws our mind away from ourselves is a bad vasana. So we are not much better than them. So we first have to set our own house in order. So we shouldn't dislike other people. That's what Bhagavan is saying here. As I said, this paragraph is a continuation of a theme in the previous two paragraphs, where what Bhagavan is emphasizing, we should not be concerned about this external world. We see things in this world, we see so many injustices in this world and so on. if we can do something to alleviate someone else's suffering, we should do so, obviously. But when we see all the wars, all the famines, all the pandemics, and all the things happening in this world, we are really powerless to, I mean, we may be able to alleviate suffering here or there, a little, it may seem to us, but we really cannot do anything to solve all the problems of the world. So our concern should be, what is the root cause of all this? Root cause of all bad actions is ego. Because vasanas are for whom? Vasanas are only ego's vasanas. So the root cause of all problems is ego. If we eradicate the ego in us, that will solve all problems. Because ultimately, there is only one ego. We ourselves have that one ego. So it's ourselves that we need to rectify. We need not be concerned about others, whether they're behaving in a good way or a bad way. Need not be our concern. Our concern is knowing. We shouldn't even be concerned about our own actions. We should be concerned about knowing what we actually are. If we know what we actually are, we will know that we were never the doer of any action. Of course, so long as we don't know what we are, we seem to be the doer of action, and therefore we are responsible for whatever actions we do. But our preoccupation should not be about whether I should do this or whether I should do that. As Bhagavan says in the 13th paragraph, since that one Parameshwara Shakti is driving all karyas, everything that should be happening is made to happen by that one Parameshwara Shakti. When such is the case, why should we, instead of yielding ourselves to it, be constantly thinking it's necessary to do like this, it's necessary to do like that? That is, we need to lose interest in doing anything. Our aim is not to do anything. Our aim is to know and thereby to be what we actually are. So as I say, in this paragraph, as in the previous paragraph, Bhagavan is telling us, is impressing upon us, we shouldn't be perturbed by, there's so many injustices in the world. We shouldn't be perturbed by them. We shouldn't dislike the bad people. Then in the next sentence, he says that in this sense, as I said, he says, however bad other people may appear to be, disliking them is not proper or appropriate. Then in the next sentence, he says, virupu virupugal irendum viruka takana. That means likes and dislikes are both fit to dislike. That means we should dislike both, that is, likes and dislikes are both to be disliked. We should avoid having likes or dislikes, because when our vasanas sprout, the first sprouting of a vasana sprout as likes and dislikes. Likes and dislikes gives rise to desires, aversions, attachments, fears, and so on. So we need to avoid having likes and dislikes. We can avoid having likes and dislikes only by not allowing ourselves to be swayed by our vasanas. To the extent to which we are swayed by our vishaya vasanas, we will inevitably have likes and dislikes. So to avoid having likes and dislikes, we need to avoid being swayed by our vasanas. So this here again, Bhagavan is giving us a very good clue. Like, this is such an important sentence. Likes and dislikes are both fit to dislike. If we think deeply about it, all the troubles we face in life are all ultimately caused by our likes and dislikes. That is, some experiences in life we consider pleasant. Some experience we consider as unpleasant. What makes a certain one experience seem pleasant and another experience seem unpleasant or painful? It is only our likes and dislikes. When we like something, if we experience that thing we like, we consider that pleasant. If we dislike something and we experience it, we find that unpleasant. So what makes any experience seem either pleasant or unpleasant is determined by whether we like it or dislike it. If we could be free of likes and dislikes, nothing that would happen in this world would perturb us. Because we have, even the even if we were in the midst of a war or in the midst of a famine, even if we were starving to death or freezing to death or dying of dehydration in a desert, it would not perturb us because we would be free of likes and dislikes. But so long as we have likes and dislikes, we some things we like, some things we dislike, and inevitably we have to experience some of the things we dislike, and we there find that painful, unpleasant. So likes and dislikes are a problem. But what is it that gives rise to the likes and dislikes? It's the vasanas. And whose vasanas are they? They're my vasanas. So it all comes back to ego. So it's only by cutting at the root. The root is ego. If we cut the root, all vasanas will come to an end, and with it all likes, dislikes, desires, attachments, hopes, fears, and so on, all will come to an end. So the root problem we have to constantly come back to is ego. And we can eradicate ego only by investigating ourselves. And to the extent to which we investigate ourselves, we are thereby weakening our Vishaya vasanas. The weaker our Vishaya vasanas, the less we will have likes and dislikes. Yes, we still have likes and dislikes, but our likes and dislikes aren't so strong. Okay, I don't like this, but I'll bear with it. It's okay, it's Bhagavan's will. If I'm to undergo this, it's Bhagavan's will. This way, we try to surrender our will to his will. We try to be free of any likes or dislikes of his own. Whatever be your will, that is happiness for me, as Bhagavan says in Arunacha Patikam, verse 2. Ninishtam enishtam, your will is my will. Imbadaku, that is happiness for me. So if we surrender our will, that means give up all our likes and dislikes, we will joyfully accept whatever happens as being the sweet will of Bhagavan. Whether previously we may have said, oh, this is unpleasant, that is pleasant. If we are surrendered, nothing is either pleasant or unpleasant. It's all the sweet will of God. So it's happiness for us, as Bhagavan says. Imbadaku, that is happiness for me. Then in the next sentence, he says, Prapanja Vishayangalil Adekamai Manate Vidakudadu. It is not appropriate to let one's mind dwell excessively on worldly matters. This is really the gist of what these three paragraphs, 17, 18, and 19, this is what they're all about. Bhagavan is telling us we shouldn't allow our mind to dwell on worldly matters. We shouldn't be concerned about how many tattvas there are, what are the qualities of the tattvas. And as I say, that applies not only to Indian philosophy, but also to science and to all other systems of knowledge about the world. We shouldn't be, all these, science is a worldly matter. Much of philosophy is worldly. It's concerned about the world. Much of, history and politics, these all worldly matters. We should be gradually weaning our mind off its interest in all these things. Yes, so long as we live in this world, we need to know a little bit about the world, but we shouldn't be too much concerned about this. We need to slowly lose interest in worldly matters and in any matter other than knowing and being what we actually are. And how to lose interest only in all other things? Only by taking more and more interest, by cultivating more and more interest in knowing and being what we actually are. So Bhagavan is constantly stressing we need to withdraw our mind from the world and fix it on ourselves. That is the implication. So all Bhagavan teachings, as I say, they all have the same implication. Bhagavan is constantly stressing in so many ways, we should not be concerned with anything other than ourselves. Our only concern should be turning our attention within to see what we actually are. When we see what we actually, and it's only by seeing what we actually are that we can surrender ourselves completely. To the extent to which we turn our attention within, we are thereby letting go of other things. So the true path of surrender is this path of Atmavichara, turning our attention within, letting go of everything else, giving up interest in all other things. And then in the next sentence, he says, up till here in this paragraph, he's been talking about our attitude towards other people. We shouldn't dislike bad people, however bad they may appear to be. We should give up our likes and dislikes. We shouldn't allow our mind to dwell on worldly things. So up to here, it's about our attitude to the world. And of course, our attitude is reflected in our actions. So here, Bhagavan, in these last three sentences, Bhagavan is talking about our actions. In the next sentence, he says, Sadhyamana varayil anya karya til pravesika kudadu. That means, to the extent possible, it is not appropriate to intrude in others' affairs. That is, when we are withdrawing our mind from the world, we should also be withdrawing our mind from trying to interfere in what concerns other people. Sometimes we may be called upon to help in certain situations. When we are called upon to help in a certain situation, and when it is appropriate to do so, okay, it may sometimes be necessary to allow our mind into other, but we shouldn't unasked intrude in other people's affairs. We should let people, everyone has their own karmas. The people who are under the sway of bad vasanas will be doing bad actions. The people who are under the sway of relatively good vasanas will be doing good actions. But that's all, that each person is responsible for their own karmas. We ourselves shouldn't be, as far as possible, we shouldn't be intruding in other people's affairs. Of course, it's not always possible to avoid it. Sometimes it is, sometimes it's appropriate for us to, but as much as possible, we should avoid it. We should avoid concerning ourselves about others' affairs. Each person has their own affairs. Of course, if someone asks us for help and we're in a position to render help, we should help. But we shouldn't unasked intrude in others' affairs. This also applies to talking to others about Bhagavan's teachings. If people ask us about Bhagavan's teachings, if people show genuine interest to know about Bhagavan's teachings, to understand Bhagavan's teaching, then only we should talk about them. Bhagavan, we are not to go out and preach Bhagavan's teachings. We are not to proselytize, to evangelize Bhagavan's teaching. That would be intruding in others' affairs. Bhagavan's teachings are not meant for, well, eventually everyone has to come to Bhagavan's path, but not everyone is ready now to come to Bhagavan's path. There are so many different paths in life, so many different spiritual paths and religious paths and so on. These different paths are to suit people at different stages of spiritual development. So if we want to try and convert other people to Bhagavan's teachings, we go and try and propagate Bhagavan's teaching, that would be intruding in others' affairs. We are not to do that. We should be, our aim is to subside more and more and more within. If someone asks us about Bhagavan's teachings, if someone wants to understand more, then by all means we can talk about them. But we shouldn't talk about Bhagavan's teachings unasked, because if we do so, if we try and foist Bhagavan's teachings on others who are not interested, that would be intruding in their affairs. Other people have their own beliefs. Their beliefs are maybe appropriate to them. Those beliefs, we may not share those beliefs, but and we may believe that but what Bhagavan offers us is much better, but for them, what they believe is appropriate for them. So we shouldn't interfere in any way in other people's affairs as much as possible. And then in the next sentence, he says, Piralku oruvan kodapadu ellam tanake kodatu kol kiran. That means all that one gives to others, one is giving only to oneself. And then in the next sentence, he says, Ivun meye arindal. If one knew this truth, evantan kodutadu orivan, who indeed would remain without giving. What Bhagavan says in the second last sentence, all but one gives to others, one gives only to oneself. In this context, the main thing he's talking about is giving good things to others. That's why he says in the next sentence, if one knew this truth, who would remain without giving? Giving means whatever is, we should give what is appropriate. So we are, again, we shouldn't think, oh, Bhagavan says it's good to give whatever we give to others, we give to ourselves. Therefore, we should go and propagate Bhagavan's teaching. That's the best thing we can give to others. That may not be the appropriate thing. Bhagavan's teachings are not appropriate for everyone because not everyone is ready for Bhagavan's teaching. So if we give something, it should be what is appropriate to the needs of that person. Here Bhagavan, the fact that he says in the last sentence, if one knew this truth, who indeed would remain without giving? What he's referring to here is giving good things. But this, what he says in this sentence equally well applies to bad things. If you do some bad to others, you're doing that bad to yourself. If you do some good to another person, you're doing that good to yourself. There are two ways we can understand this. Firstly, we can understand from the level of the law of karma. Whatever we do, whatever actions we do, sooner or later, the fruit of that action will come back to us if it's ordained by Bhagavan. So whatever actions we do, if you give trouble to others, those troubles will come back to you sooner or later, if it's ordained in your prarabdha. And if you do good to others, that'll come back to you. So that's one level at which we can understand this. If all but one gives to others, one gives only to oneself. But a deeper way of understanding this is actually there are no others. What actually exists is only ourselves. So what we see as others are only ourselves. So if we give to others, we're giving only to ourselves. This is why the law of... This is the underlying reason for the law of karma. That is it's because if you do bad to other people, but since those other people are not actually other than yourself, they're yourself alone, if you do bad to them, you're doing bad to yourself. So that comes back in the form of an unpleasant fruit to be experienced. Because you did a bad action, you have to experience an unpleasant fruit. So the reason why doing good actions yields good fruit and doing bad actions yield bad fruit is whatever we do, we are doing only to ourselves, because we alone actually exist. What we see as others are actually only ourselves. If we knew those others, who we took to be those who seem to us to be others, if we recognize that they were only ourselves, who indeed would remain without giving? That is the deeper meaning of this, what Bhagavan says in this sentence. That is, there are no others. What those who seem to be other than ourselves are actually ourselves. So whatever we give to others, we are giving only to ourselves. So we should give to others only what is appropriate. We shouldn't give trouble to others. We should give help to others wherever we can. We should give whatever is appropriate to people. And if we knew the truth that whatever we give to others, we're giving only to ourselves, who wouldn't give? The reason we don't give is that we don't see ourselves in others. We see others as other. And so I'll keep this for myself because I am separate, you are separate. We need to give up Veda Bhava, this attitude of difference between ourselves and others. We can give up this view that others are other only by turning within more and more and more. The more we turn within, the more ego subsides. The more ego subsides, the less distinction we will feel between ourselves and others. So if we see another person suffering, we will suffer to see that person suffering because we will see that other person as ourselves. So what Bhagavan says here, though it seems to be a very, it may seem to be a very ordinary thing, but whatever you give to others, you're giving to yourself, that actually has a very, very deep meaning. It has a meaning at the level of the law of karma, but it has a much deeper underlying meaning. Whatever we see as other than ourselves is only ourselves, because we alone exist. So whatever bad we do to others, we are doing that bad only to ourselves, and we will suffer the consequences. So there's that is the importance of paragraphs like this. Is if we are following Bhagavan's path of self-investigation, our aim should be to turn our attention more and more within. So the more we are interested in turning within, the less we will be interested in external things, the less we will be concerned about external things. Yes, there are bad people in this world. They're not actually, they themselves are not bad. They happen to be under the sway of bad vasanas. So we should not be, they will sooner or later. We are all on a spiritual path. As Bhagavan says in the eighth verse of Arunachala Ashtakam, he says, wait a second, I'll just get that. It's a very important verse. Well, Bhagavan says in the eighth paragraph of Arunachala Ashtakam, water showered by clouds which rise from the ocean will not stop, even if obstructed, until it reaches its ocean abode. Likewise, the embodied soul which rises from you will not stop, even though it wanders along many paths that it encounters, until it reaches you. That is, will not stop until it reaches you, even though it wanders along so many paths on the way. So the first analogy he gives is of the water, water that's evaporated from the ocean and becomes clouds, and then it pours as rain on the hills and it flows down, and it will not rest until it returns to the ocean. So it'll be flowing in the form of a river. If it comes to a lake or to a reservoir, it may seem to rest for a while, but it, again, either it will be evaporated from that lake or reservoir and again come falling as rain, or sooner or later it'll flow out of the lake and it'll continue its onward journey to the ocean. So like that, we may follow so, that if we look at the different people in the world, they're following so many different paths, but eventually they all have to come back they have to come to this path sooner or later, because this is, whatever bad actions people may be doing, all they're doing actually, they're seeking happiness. They just happen to be seeking happiness in the wrong way. We are all seeking happiness, and we cannot rest until we return to the infinite ocean of happiness that we really are. And then he gives another analogy. Idaveli alayinum nile ile pulaku. Though it wanders in the vast sky, for a bird there is no place of rest. That implies in the sky there's no place of rest. If a bird is flying in the sky, so long as it's flying in the sky, it cannot rest. In order to rest, it has to come back to earth. Idum nilum aladu ille. Except the earth, there is no place. That means there's no place of rest for it. Varu vari sala kadan. What it must do is go the way it came. So from the earth, it flew up into the sky. If it wants to rest, it has to come back again to the earth. Likewise, we have risen from Arunachala, from the infinite ocean of happiness and love that we actually are, which is what is called Arunachala. We have risen from this ocean. We need to go back the way we came. Bhagavan often used to say to people, go back the way you came. What Bhagavan meant by go back the way you came, we have risen as ego by coming outwards. We need to turn back within and return and go back the way we came. We have risen and we need to subside. And then he ends by saying, we are varu vari sendrida. when the soul goes back the way it came, imba kadal une maruvidam aruna budarane. It will merge in you the ocean of happiness, aruna budaran, aruna mountain. So what Bhagavan is saying here, eventually we will all return to our source. We have it, but however much, like a bird flying in the sky, we cannot rest except by returning to our source. Like the water that's been evaporated from the ocean and is blowing around as clouds in the sky, it cannot rest until it returns to the ocean. Likewise, we cannot rest until we return to the ocean. So sooner or later, we all have to go back the way we came. The way we came was by rising. Going back the way we came means subsiding back within. So we all have to turn back within. So whatever, when we look outwards and see the condition of the world, see all the good things people are doing, the bad things people are doing, these are all following so many different paths. But all of these people, good people and bad people, saints and sinners alike, all have to eventually come back to the source. And the way to come back to the source, it is from within that we have come outwards. We have to go back within. We have to turn our attention back within and merge into our source. That is why Bhagavan in these paragraphs in 17, 18, 19, Bhagavan is telling us, don't concern yourself with the world. Your only duty is to turn back within. He in that verse, he says, he uses the word when he's talking about the bird, he uses the word kadan. Kadan in this context means what it must do, but kadan also means duty. So its duty is to go back. The bird cannot rest in the sky. Its duty is to come back to the earth sooner or later. So our duty is only to go back within. So that is what we should be concerned about. We shouldn't be concerned about the world. The whole world, as Bhagavan says in the 13th paragraph, when that one Parameshwara Shakti is driving all karyas, so that one Parameshwara Shakti is taking care of everything. Why should we think, there's so many injustices in the world, I have to do something to rectify this. Who are we to rectify anything? If we want to improve the condition of the world, all we need to do is subside within. If we eradicate our own ego, that itself is sufficient. And in fact, if we eradicate our own ego, if we eradicate ourselves, the ego, we will thereby solve all problems. Because as Bhagavan says in verse 26 of Uludanapdu, Ahandeyundayan and Etumundaham. If ego comes into existence, everything comes into existence. Ahandeyundrel, Indru and Etum. If ego doesn't exist, everything doesn't exist. Ahandeyayavamam. Ego itself is everything. Adalal, Yadu Idu Indru Nadale, Overdal Yavaman all. Therefore, know that investigating oneself is giving up everything. Because if we investigate ourselves, ego will thereby subside and merge back into its source, and everything else will subside back within. This is what he says in the next paragraph, which we're going to be talking about next time. He begins by saying, Ta nerandal sakalam amerum. If oneself rises, everything rises. Tana danginal sakalam adangam. If oneself subsides, everything subsides. So the whole purpose of what Bhagavan is, what he's teaching us in paragraphs 17, 18, 19, is that we all these things appear only because we've risen as ego. Therefore, we shouldn't take interest in these things. We need to turn back within and subside back into our source. That is the implication of what Bhagavan is teaching us in these. That is the The core implication that Bhagavan is teaching us in these paragraphs, in fact, in all his teachings, he's emphasizing the same thing. We should not take interest in anything other than ourselves. Other things appear because we've risen as ego. We've risen as ego because we've allowed our attention away from ourselves. As Bhagavan said, ego, we cannot give any cause for the appearance of ego, but if at all we are to give a cause, we can say it's avichara, non-vichara. Because if we do vichara, if we investigate what we are, we'll find there never was any, we have never risen as ego at all. So we seem to have risen as ego only because we haven't investigated ourselves. Therefore, all we need to do is to investigate ourselves. Om Namo Bhagavate Sri Arunachala Ramanaya.